Let's begin week 37 of our 4.5 year journey through God's inspired word. And today I would like for you to start with me in Numbers chapter 33. This contains a list of all the major long-term encampments. And when I say long-term, probably more than a week, or roughly a week or more, that occurred during the travels of Israel from Egypt to the Promised Land. Now, we have already seen the events that happened after they left Mount Sinai and how they had the graves of greediness at a place called Kibroth Hatava. And that is mentioned in verse number 16 of Numbers 33 as one of the encampments they spent time at. Then we start seeing the encampments that must have occurred during the penalty phase of Israel's wilderness journey. That is, the extra 38.5 years of wandering until all of those above the age of 20 that had been part of the rebellion died off. And so there are about 18 encampments mentioned here. And when you divide that, about 19 encampments, and when you divide that up over about 38 years, it must mean that they spent roughly 2 years at each of these encampments. And now they didn't have it horrible because God was providing them water. God was providing them the manna 6 days a week, double portion on that sixth day. They are not having their feet swell or their clothes wear out. That's a psalm that reminds us what happened of the miraculous provision of God during this time. They weren't even being attacked by wild animals, including snakes that were part of this region during this time. So they're just basically on a very nice time out, waiting until this generation passes from the scene. Now, what I want to do is I'm going to just read the names of the places that are mentioned here, because the pattern is the same. It says they set out from, and then they camped at. And so here are the names, starting in verse 17. Hazeroth, Rithma, Rimon Perez, Libna, Risa, Kehalathat, Mount Shefer, Harada, Makhelot, Tahat, Tera, Mithka, Hashmana, Mosherot, Bene Yachin, and Hor Hagigd Gad, Jotbata, Abrana, and then finally we arrive at a place that we can pin down with great precision. Verse 35, they set out from Abrana and camped at Ezion Geber. Now, Ezion Geber is going to later be a port city for the kingdoms of David and Solomon and Judah after. It is located on the northern end of the Gulf of Aqaba, which is an arm of the Red Sea, which of course then is connected to the Indian Ocean. So you can find it. I'm looking at it right now on my copy of Google Earth. And it is a place that Israelis like to go still on their side of the border from, I think it is, Saudi Arabia. They go down to this port city area for holidays to be at the beach and things like that. So it is roughly about 60 miles south of the location that I identify as Kadesh Barnea, which is where we see they go next in the list. Verse 36, and they set out from Ezion Geber, and they camped in the wilderness of Zin, that is Kadesh. And that will take us then to Numbers 20, verse number 1, which says, "And the people of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh." And we have now, in just those few moments, with just those particular places of encampment, we've jumped forward 38 plus years, or roughly 38 years, since we last were reading in the book of Numbers. And a lot of people have died. We are now in the 40th year of the Exodus. We've got only this year left in the penalty phase of the timeout that God has assigned. The oldest people in the encampment are going to be the family of Miriam, Aaron, and Moses, in that order. Miriam is in her 120s somewhere, probably 126, 127, somewhere in that region, I would guess. Aaron is 123, and Moses is 120. And so they are the most ancient of all the Israelis in this 40th year of the Exodus. And then you've got the next crew that's the oldest would be the two spies that were good, Joshua and Caleb. We know that Caleb is in his 80s, and Joshua must be pretty close to that as well, because they seem to be of the same generation. And then after that, more than likely, you've got a few left of that generation that was over the age of 20 whenever the penalty was assessed, which makes them roughly 59 and then into their 60s. So they're in that range right there. And they are the remnant that remain to die during this final year of the wandering. Now, why am I putting such an emphasis on that? Because we read in Numbers 20, verse 1, that Miriam died there and was buried there. So Miriam dies at Kadesh sometime in the first, maybe second month of the 40th year. And she is the first of the three that have been involved from this family in the leadership of these people to pass away outside the Promised Land. And I believe at some point right around this time, Moses sat down and wrote a psalm, an expression of his heart that is, as far as we know, the only psalm in the book of Psalms that comes from Moses. And it's Psalm number 90. And I'd like to look at it as we think about how the deaths of all this generation of Israel has taken place during this time that we've jumped over today. And it's all because of their sin, and it brings grief to Moses, and he wishes to pray about it and maybe give a little teaching from it through the power of the Holy Spirit. Psalm 90. "Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God." So he acknowledges that God has no beginning, no end. He is outside of creation. Verse 3, "You return man to dust and say, 'Return, O children of man.'" And so that's the penalty that came from Genesis chapter 3. From dust you were taken, to dust you're going to return, and it's all because of sin. Verse 4, "For 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it's past, or as a watch in the night." Now, you might recognize the phrasing there from where that's quoted by Peter in the New Testament, where he is telling people only 30 years past Jesus' ascension, when people are mocking the idea of Jesus' return, he tries to help everybody understand God doesn't look at time like we do. 1,000 years in his sight, it's nothing. It's as if it were just the next day. Or it's just a certain time in the morning. It's no big deal. Now, the reason I want to bring that up and emphasize is that some people have tried to take Peter's words and make it into some sort of mathematical equation to say that 1,000 years equals one day in God time. And they'll even say, well, you know, there's been 6,000 years of human history according to the King James Bible, and therefore we must be coming very, very close to the seventh day of God's week, and therefore the millennium is that seventh day. And so they'll even be hyping everybody up on the idea that we're almost ready for the second coming of Jesus, because 1,000 years is like a day in God's sight. And I reject that that type of equating, and it's not what Moses had in mind when he was writing here. It's basically God is timeless. He doesn't look at time like we do. Verse number 5, you sweep them away as with a flood. Think of a flash flood. The Middle East is filled with these wadis, wet weather streams. And it won't be raining where you're at, and then suddenly water comes on top of you because it was raining way far away in the highlands, and it fills this wet weather stream suddenly. And so flash floods, very, very dangerous. And so that's how he looks at death. One moment you're there, and the next you're gone. They are like a dream. And you know how that is. You wake up, and you're like, man, I was dreaming something, but I can't remember what it was. It's gone now. Like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning, it flourishes, and it is renewed. In the evening, it fades and withers. And we've seen that in poetry throughout the Bible, both Old and New Testament, that man is like the grass or the flowers of the field. They're all bright and pretty and great-looking in the morning, and then as a nice hot day hits them, they're all shriveled up and they drop their petals and they're drooping over in the evening. It's just the way it is with life. Because of sin, because of the penalty that has been placed upon us, because of sin at the very beginning of human history, we die. Verse number 7. For we are brought to an end by your anger. Now, don't think of this idea of this really rage type of anger. Think of it as the penalty for sin brings God's wrath or anger. By your wrath, we are dismayed. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end with a sigh. So he's just writing here about how sad it is that we're not living the life that God originally intended, which was a life forever with him. Because of sin, life is brief when compared to eternity, when compared to what it was supposed to be. And then he gives us a sense of what must have been the average lifespans for a lot of the peoples that they were aware of. Now, a lot of the Israelis were living into their hundreds. Moses is a clear example of that, and his whole family. But listen to these words. It sounds similar to where we're kind of at in our lifespans today in the more health-filled regions of the world. The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80. And yet, Their span is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone, and we fly away. So we live into our 70s. Maybe a lot of people make it into their 80s. But eventually, time wears on them. The curse gets them, and they die. I've preached many funerals, and it doesn't matter even if the person was over 100. People still felt in their hearts, this isn't right. This person went too soon. And the reason we have that reaction is because we know in our hearts somewhere that we're intended to be forever. And that's good to know that Jesus is coming back to fix that physical problem and give us our eternal bodies. Verse 11, who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? So teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. So we face the fact that we're mortal, physically mortal. And from that, we start using that mortal time to grow in our relationship with God and with each other. Verse 13, return, O he who is. How long? Have pity on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, and for as many years as we have seen evil. Now, the evil there, sometimes I think our English Bible translators do an injustice. That word means rottenness. So sometimes it has a moral quality to it. So sin is evil. It's rotten. But sometimes it's just the fact that things are tough and hard, such as we are all assigned to have hard work to get through our lives in. That's part of the penalty placed upon Adam. And it all ends in our physical death at some point, sooner than what was intended. And that's pretty rotten. That's horrible. It's affliction on us. And so that's what Moses is focusing on here, is that all this tough stuff is part of our assignment of life, ending in death, but we can still have God make us glad during those times. And I love that part of being a Christian, is that we can still enjoy life even during the rough times. Verse 16, let your work be shown to your servants and your glorious power to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be with us, and establish the work of our hands upon us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. So he makes this appeal. God, show us your work, and let us do that work, and that work be established and long-lasting. So his prayer focuses on the reality of death, the inevitability of it, and yet comes back around to the need that we all have to thank God for what we do have, thank him for the joy that we can have in the midst of this cycle that has been brought about by sin, and do our best to get his wisdom and to do things his way so that we can impact properly on other people. All right, so Psalm 90 is written by Moses, probably somewhere during this time of death of an entire generation because of sin, because of their bad choices. And he buries his big sister on the border, the southern border of the Promised Land at Kadesh Barnea. And then he goes back to doing his work. He knows he's got another year left to get these people to the Promised Land and say goodbye and bury the last remaining members of the rebellious generation. And speaking of the rebellious generation, well, here's where some of them get themselves under the skin of Moses. Verse 2, there was no water for the congregation. So apparently we're talking about not too long after they arrived at Kadesh Barnea. And they assembled themselves together against Moses and against Aaron. The people quarreled with Moses and said, "Oh, would that we'd perish with our brothers who perish before he who is. Why have you brought the assembly of he who is into this wilderness that we should die here, both we and our cattle? Why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It's no place for grain or figs or vines or pomegranates. There's no water to drink." And when you look at this region that I think Kadesh Barnea is located in, it's about midway between the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba and the southern end of what used to be the Dead Sea. And it is this valley that is just a wasteland. The place that I suspect is the location of Kadesh Barnea is, I think it's a community called Paran right now. It's on the east side of this desolate valley. And it's a big green blop on the Google Earth map because they're tapping underground water to pump it up and be able to have at least some vegetation grow there in that region. But it's the exception to see that greenery in this area. So that's where they're at. And so the people start griping, "We don't got no water. You've got us in a place where you can't grow crops. You promised us you were taking us to the promised land. And here we are, almost 40 years into our journey, and you still haven't kept your promise. And you know what? We'd be better off to have all died." Well, guess what? Some of these guys are among that generation probably that are still yet to die. But unfortunately for Moses, some of them are probably the people who were kids back at the time from Exodus, from Egypt, and they are still griping about it. And this gets under Moses' skin. And I can appreciate this. I've never had thousands upon thousands of people gripe about what I was doing in church leadership, but I've certainly had a few handfuls, and sometimes maybe a couple of double handfuls of people gripe about the things that I was trying to do for the Lord. And it hurts. And sometimes you just want to lash out. And unfortunately for Moses, he chooses to do the lashing out. So verse number 6, Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly into the entrance of the tent of meeting, and that might be Moses' office tent. Remember, I've told you before, it's sometimes hard to tell which is the tabernacle and which is Moses' office. The tabernacle is at the center of the encampment. The office tent is outside the encampment. And so whichever place they went, Moses and Aaron fell on their faces, and the glory of He Who Is appeared to them. And He Who Is spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the staff," that's the power staff, the rod that's budded, the rod that's been turned into a snake a couple of times now. "Take the staff and assemble the congregations, the congregation, you and Aaron, your brother, and tell the rock before their eyes to yield its water, and so you shall bring water out of a rock for them and give drink to the congregation and their cattle." Now, he's done this before, where he has struck a rock, water came out, and the people had sufficient to drink. Well, he's now been told, you go, and there's nothing said about striking the rock here. It is about speaking to the rock, and I think that might be important. Moses took the staff from before He Who Is, as he commanded him, because it's been laying in front of where the Ark of the Covenant's at. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock. And he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels! Shall we bring water for you out of this rock?" And notice, he calls them what they are, and I think he might have been fine with that. But the moment he used this "we," he crosses a line. Because he is angry. He is upset. He's let these guys get under his skin. And he's had about enough of them for the past 40 years. And so he says, "Why am I always having to do these things for you?" And then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock with his staff twice. And that might very well be the second place that he makes a huge mistake. Because he was not told to strike the rock, and yet he does it two times. And there are some commentators that will point out that Jesus is clearly indicated as being this rock that provides the water of life during the wilderness experience. It's right there in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And that the rock, Jesus, was only struck once for the sins of the people when he died. And that Moses has actually broken a symbol here by striking the rock twice. And that he is also not following the instructions of God to the letter when God simply told him to speak to the rock. And the water does come out abundantly. That's great. And the congregation drank and their livestock, so they've got all of the hydration that they need. But Moses crossed a line that God cannot let slide. And when we come back tomorrow, we will find out that this action cost Moses his chance to go in to the promised land.